beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191.
Something sleeps inside us and seldom awakens. The sleeper must awaken.
The dream unfolds.
The beginning is a delicate time. Know then that you are listening to The Projection Booth with Mike and Mando Justin.
Father! The sleeper has awakened!
In the year 1984, Universal Pictures released Dune. Directed by David Lynch, the film was produced by Rafaela De Laurentiis and executive produced by her father, Dino. So what is Dune? Written by Frank Herbert, it was serialized in Analog Magazine from 1963 to 1965, and it was finally published in 1965 by Chilton Books, where it later won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards in 1966. It's kind of a story of a messiah in space. Justin, I defy you to summarize Dune in less than 30 seconds. Go.
Two great houses. The Emperor, the Spice, Rebel Force, The Worms, Kyle MacLachlan, Water of Life, Parable on Religion, Parable on Drugs. Good movie. Dave Lynch was the wrong guy for it, but overall, it's a good movie.
All right, so I guess we're going to start our discussion in earnest right now with the whole idea that David Lynch was the wrong person for this movie. Dune was set to come to the big screen twice before David Lynch finally was assigned to the project. At one point, Alejandro Jodorowsky was attached to the film, and it sounds like thousands and thousands of dollars were spent, and this thing was really set to go. He had it casted, he had designs done for all this stuff, he had Mobius and Chris Foss, and then I don't know what happened, but it just kind of petered out.
The thing that I find most interesting about the fact that Jodorowsky was going to do Dune was not that Jodorowsky was going to do Dune. It's the fact that he was going to involve Salvador Dali in Dune. That was the selling point for me. That was when I was like, hell yeah. Like, I would have rather seen that Dune than the David Lynch Dune. Now, I know that we're both huge Dune fans, and so I'm definitely not anti-Dune in any capacity, but I would have rather seen a Salvador Dali Dune.
The whole thing with Jodorowsky using Dali was that Dali was going to be paid $10,000 an hour. So he was going to get him in there for an hour and then quickly dispose of him and get basically a robot double to be in there for the rest of the film.
Listen to what you just said. A robot double. How would you not want to see that? That's like Salvador Dali and Heartbeeps.
So after Jodorowsky spent all this money, the project kind of languished for a while, and then Dino De Laurentiis bought the rights for it, and he wanted the other Scott brother, Ridley, to be the director of this film. He would have been coming right off of Alien, and he still had ties with H.R. Giger at the time, and so Giger started to design a lot of the Dune product. Of anything, the Giger stuff is what's very interesting, and I do like some of the designs he came up for. His designs of the sandworms are definitely, they're pretty kooky. And his design of the Baron's Palace, Baron Harkonnen, some of it actually kind of came back a little bit with some of the statues that you see outside on Getty Prime. But yeah, it was very cool stuff as to...
And that makes sense because if you look at the statues, like the establishing shots of Getty Prime, they have a Metropolis feel to them, a sense, you know, and they're both in that same realm.
I can definitely see where David Lynch liked the Harkonnen stuff more than anything else in the entire film, because that kind of really is David Lynch's realm, just that kind of over-industrialized, dirty, grimy.
You know, I said at the beginning of the show that David Lynch, I don't think, was the right guy for Dune in a sense. And, you know, I think people rip on Dune for a lot of valid reasons. But the fact is, if you dislike Dune, you don't understand David Lynch. You don't understand the themes that he's obsessed with, which are like what you just said, industrialism, dream states, electricity, and lights. And those are all heavy in Dune. You know, I know that you've read the book, and I've read the book, but we both probably haven't read it in many years. And so prior to the show, I actually went back and revisited the book in the 24-hour audiobook version, which was actually really good. I did get through it all. What's interesting about the book, actually, is, you know, in the film, they're called the Harkonnens, and in the audiobook, they're called the Harkonnens. Now, one thing, you know, about the book that's quite different is Paul Atreides is actually 15 years old in the book. And obviously Kyle MacLachlan is not 15 in the film.
I think he was 22 when he made this.
You know, there's that difference. And then, you know, there's the fact that the planet that the Atreides live on, it's a very beautiful place. And there's talk of Lady Jessica going out and smelling the flowers. Now, didn't you tell me that there was actually you saw a still shot of, you know, maybe like a behind the scenes thing where Lynch actually shot some stuff like that?
Yeah, there's one scene in, God, there were at least two retrospectives on Dune that I've seen. And one of those has Jessica out there walking and there's the camera rolling on her. And then even some of the most famous shots from the production of the film, which are Lynch and Frank Herbert there holding the slate for the, you know, the first day of shooting, that's all taking place, I believe, in that set, because it looked like she was wearing the exact same outfit as well, because there's another shot with Frank Herbert and her and I think Kyle MacLachlan, and they're all holding the slate.
I don't understand why so many fanatics out there that love the Dune series hate the movie so much, because Lynch did actually a really good job in terms of paring down the book into a movie. I mean, the whole basic concept from the book is clearly there, but what's not in the film is the extreme detail that goes into the characters. Like, you learn so much more about Gurney and Shadow Mapes. It's basically, there's a ton of banter, you know, with characters that you don't see in the film.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are some characters that are dropped from the book to the film that really wouldn't add that much to the film if they had existed in the film. And for me, and this kind of leads into our first clip, the Dune movie that Lynch did is kind of the gold standard, because it had Frank Herbert right there, it sounded like, the whole darn time. And the whole thing that you were talking about, the Harkonnens versus the Harkonnens, or however it was pronounced in the audiobook, Herbert was there, and they specifically talk about asking Herbert how to pronounce some of these things. You know, some of these words stem from Arabic tongues, and then some of them just stem from his imagination. To me, everything that's pronounced in the movie is the way that Herbert wanted it to be. This was recorded before the release of Dune, and it was a Walden audiobooks presentation, so forgive the sound quality, but this is an interviewer who is unnamed, unfortunately. You're going to hear him, you're going to hear Frank Herbert, and you're going to hear David Lynch talking about the production of Dune.
The day I finished reading the book, I met with Dino in his office, and I was so high from finishing the book, so thrilled with what I'd read, I signed on, and I didn't really know it was going to be 3.5 of this type of a year.
Frank, you're obviously satisfied with the result.
Yes,
you said so many times.
But the funny thing happened. Dino called me. I didn't know David from Adams on Fox, and he called me and he said that he had hired David Lynch to direct the film of Dune. And this was after a couple of, I think they would have been disasters, but and David knows why. So I said, David who? And he said, David Lynch. He said, Elephant Man. And I hadn't seen Elephant Man. So I went out and got a tape of it and played it on my video. And I had this funny gut sensation. We had the guy who could do it. When you're doing a film, you're from the written word, you're translating into a different language. It's as though you were translating from English to Swahili. The visual language is a different language. And there was such subtlety and such beauty in the Elephant Man. I've never told David this, but this is true. This is what happened to me. I had this gut sensation. I said, we've got him. You know, the guy who can do it.
What was Frank's participation in the process of the film?
I signed on to do Dune. I try to be true to the essence of Frank's, book, and which is not an easy thing, because there's so many different lines and so many different little things swimming about. It's picking and choosing and condensing and, all sorts of things. So Frank's contribution was, the book and his support from day one all the way through to now. And he's always available, for, questions, and he's read almost every, draft. I did 7 drafts. And he's, allowed me to, do my thing. And his book is packed full with, these, what I call, seed ideas. There's the big ideas, but there's so many little seed ideas. Those he let me, sprout and run with. And that was the thrill for me, because there are things in the movie that were sparked, you know, by Frank, but they were allowed to, you know, to grow out. And and I think it would be neat for people to who have read the book. They'll see a difference, but it's true to the essence of Frank's ideas.
The film begins as the book begins, and it ends essentially as the end, as the book ends. And I hear my dialogue all the way through it. Not just my dialogue, but there's lots of other dialogue. But I had the funny sensation in watching the rough cut, some of the cuts, the things that are not in there, of feeling that they'd happened just off stage, or that we'd gone beyond them, but they'd happened, that we hadn't really lost them. There are only two scenes that that I missed in the film, but I know why they were cut. And they were pets of mine, and you shouldn't have any pets when you're doing a screen.
No, they were pets of mine too, but I know which scenes they are. But you know, those are the things that that's the trouble. The film right now is 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it rolls along gangbusters. Certain scenes that Frank and I both liked, I think would have, stopped the film.
David, did you, as a filmmaker, I think by anyone's estimation, Dune was written very visually. I mean, as a piece of literature, the visual description, just the visualization of it is very immediate. Did that help you in your translation to the screen?
Well, like I said, I really, in a way, forget a lot of the book now because there have been so many drafts of a screenplay in between. But some things, I really think in your mind you think that Frank described things, but when you go searching, some things are described, of course, but a lot of things are left to your imagination, even in the book. And
that was deliberate, I might add.
And you get a feeling, and then your mind takes over from there. And so when a lot of times we'll go searching for descriptions of things, they weren't there. Or I realized that I was picturing something, and I was, falling in love with, what I was picturing. And so, like I said, Frank allowed me to go with, my interpretation in how things looked. And because of that, I was able to. My interpretation was one thing, and then I started working with Tony, and we went through two or three different steps into sort of the stratosphere of interpretation, and we got clicking on four really nifty different worlds and the look of each one.
So the motion picture is truly an entity unto itself.
Yeah.
If you love the book, you'll love the motion picture even more because it takes on a new dimension.
I can see how everyone who reads the book is going to interpret it, and their interpretation is not mine. But I have to, it has to go through me as a director. It's like I always say, like a filter, and things pass through me, and it's not going to be other people's interpretation. Some people may love it, and some people say it, it's not what they pictured, and they would be disappointed. That's the way it is.
Again, the book being so visual, some people, anyone who's read it has been there before.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about the tools that you had to employ as a filmmaker, especially a modern filmmaker in this day and age? What did you do? What did you have fun with?
Every technique known to filmmaking has been used on this picture, except for stop motion, strangely enough, but every other kind of thing. So I've learned a tremendous amount of, technical things. We've built over about 80 sets in what amounted to 16 sound stages down in Mexico. We've traveled all over the world, Rafael and I, Rafael de Laurentiis is a producer, first looking for locations and finally going to Mexico. I've seen actors, for this picture all over the world, and people in this film are from all over the world. The crew is from all over the world. At one point, there was 1,700 people on the crew. And that's a huge amount of people. And sometimes I'd turn around on the set, there'd be 600 people. They're not extras, crew people, or visitors, or camera crews, or whatever, on the set. So it's been a strange experience, but a huge, fantastic experience.
So there are two more Dune projects, potential Dune projects already
In the works. I've started writing on the script on Dune 2. It needs a lot more work, and then I'll show it to Frank and see what he thinks.
He'll be a tough audience.
Tougher than hell.
Now, it's interesting that Frank didn't do the screenplays for Dune. Why did that happen?
Well, I did a screenplay, and it was awful.
I never read Frank's script. I don't believe it was awful. I don't know, you know.
It was too long. It lacked the proper visual metaphors. I was too close to the book to be able to see it as a film. David didn't have that problem. Working on this film with David has taught me one great deal about taking the printed word, a screenplay, and making it into a film. Now I feel competent to do a screenplay. I don't know if I could do a screenplay of one of my own books, but, yes, I can. I'm doing it.
Good. So you have definitely learned from each other in this experience a great deal.
I would say so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that would make the next two pictures, I would think, something you'd look forward to.
Oh, yeah, I look forward to, you know, I'm a little bit, what we all are, we're a little bit duned out right now.
Mm-hmm.
But
duned in, we say.
Right. 3.5 years you've been on this project.
That's right. 3.5 years.
It's a long time. But the results are, from what everyone says, well worth the effort. Have you thought of how the public's going to respond to this? In other words, as you've made the film, have you had a place in your mind where you've been contemplating what the response will be, how people will react to what you're doing?
Well, I've thought about a lot about the films that I've, you know, loved and what it was. It was an experience that I had while watching them that I couldn't get anywhere else. I never got it anywhere else, ever. And I would so gladly pay my $5 to, you know, to have that experience. And it took me, the films that I loved took me to another place, even if it was 20 years ago or present day, but another place, and gave me an experience. And I think that's what I hope Dune will do. And it's four different, you know, worlds and a trip through them that you can't experience anywhere else, ever.
Did you feel threatened by the fact that so many readers had no doubt seen Dune so many times before they'll have the opportunity to come into the theater and see your Dune?
I live in fear 24 hours a day.
So that's right before the movie's coming out. I think one of the biggest problems of the film Dune is the way that the film was marketed. I knew that there were Dune toys out there, and I knew that there were Dune coloring books, but just finding some of the other crazy stuff out there, like Dune activity books, here's a recipe for spice cookies, and, you know, doing a connect the dots to make the third stage guild navigator. There were so many products tied into this. We have to remember that this is coming out right after Return of the Jedi. You know, Star Wars has happened, Empire's happened, so the whole idea of marketing movies has completely changed. And that's where I think the real downfall of Dune happened. It's just how strongly it was marketed, and that it was marketed to the wrong people.
If I would have been old enough, I would have owned every single Dune action figure. I had no clue there are Dune action figures. But what's interesting is the overhype and the commercialism of the film almost matched, the equivalence of what Kiss does.
It was funny, last week when we talked to Chris Gore, he had mentioned to us that the thing that lit the fire under his ass for Film Threat was just how much he hated Dune. Dune was panned by the audience that it was really aimed for. At least that's how the marketing was aimed at. Because when you look at the film, it's not a kid's movie. This is not a movie that they should have been selling on TV. It's not a movie that should have had Kenner action figures. It definitely doesn't need a freaking coloring book. I mean, one of the things that cracks me up about the coloring book, there's a page to be colored that's of Piter and Duke Leto Atreides dead. Duke Leto's at his table and Piter's on the floor. And yeah, here's a nice little scene for you kids to color. The hell were they thinking when they came to marketing this movie? It's just they were completely clueless. So when it came to the critics just savaged this film. I found a clip of Gene Siskel talking about it. He went first on At the Movies that week, and he just completely lays into this film. So again, I have to apologize for the audio quality of this clip, but I think that the content of it speaks volumes.
Dune, one of five science fiction films being released this holiday season, is the worst, according to me, by a wide margin. It's physically ugly. It contains at least a dozen gory gross-out scenes. Some of its special effects are cheap, surprisingly cheap, because this film cost a reported $40 to $45 million, and its story is confusing beyond belief. In case I haven't made myself clear, I hated watching this film. I wish I could have left after 20 minutes. I couldn't. I had to stay there another 2 hours. Dune takes place on four planets. I could never keep them straight. It introduces dozens of characters with unpronounceable names. I couldn't keep them straight. Basically, what's going on, I think, is that this young man's mission is to destroy the universe's dependency on a substance called spice, which has everybody doped up, and also to harness some devil worms. If he can do all that, he's going to bring peace to the world. But what a load of junk we have to sit through, with people getting their nipples ripped off their chests and having fluid drop out, with a premature baby being born in blood, with facial boils being lanced. It's like a medical show. The filmmaking is shoddy also in several respects. Giant holes in the story are filled with apparently last-minute voice-over narrations to explain what's happening to characters. Crucial action scenes are begun, then needlessly interrupted, sometimes forgotten. Basically, I watched two things while watching Dune. I watched the movie, yes. And I watched my watch. This film was pure torture to sit through. 5 minutes into this film, I yelled out at the screen, "I give up!" And then I had to watch the rest of it.
Mike, you gave me a review, you know, an actual written review that Roger Ebert did when it came out. And man, I'll tell you, it's got to be the worst movie review I've ever read in the entire history of film criticism. It's so off point, and I can't even understand how he could even write such words like that. It's, you know, he just clearly didn't get it. Like, yeah, you know, there are some valid points to a lot of people's arguments in terms of the film, but Ebert just didn't get it. And he's notorious for that too. Like, look at all the stuff that's happened to him over the years. Perfect example, and most recently, you know, look what happened to him with Joaquin's Phoenix I'm Still Here documentary, where he wrote the review about him really having the breakdown, and look what a putz he looked like after that whole thing. So I don't understand why Roger Ebert is the most well-known critic, because in my opinion, he's the critic that gets things the least.
So Justin, before you go on, I just want to say that I have a surprise for us, and that I actually got Roger Ebert to record a bit of his review of Dune for us. So I'd like to play that right now, if you don't mind.
Let's hear it.
This movie is a real mess, an incomprehensible, ugly, unstructured, pointless excursion into the murky realms of one of the most confusing screenplays of all time. The movie's plot will no doubt mean more to people who've read Herbert than to those who are walking in cold. It has to do with the young hero's personal quest. The movie has so many characters, so many unexplained or incomplete relationships, and so many parallel courses of action that it's sometimes a toss-up whether we're watching a story or just an assembly of meditations on themes introduced by the novels. The movie is like a dream. Occasionally a striking image will swim into view. The alien brain floating in brine, for example, or our first glimpse of the giant sandworms plowing through the desert. If the first look is striking, however, the movie's special effects don't stand up to scrutiny. The heads of the sandworms begin to look more and more as if they came out of the same factory that produced Kermit the Frog. They have the same mouths. An evil baron floats through the air on trajectories all too obviously controlled by wires. The spaceships in the movie are so shabby, so lacking in detail or dimension, that they look almost like those student films where plastic models are shot against a tablecloth. Nobody looks very happy in this movie. Actors stand around in ridiculous costumes, mouthing dialogue that has little or no context. They are not even given scenes that work on a self-contained basis. Portentous lines of pop profundity are allowed to hang in the air unanswered, while additional characters arrive or leave on unexplained errands. Dune looks like a project that was seriously out of control from the start. Sets were constructed, actors were hired, no usable screenplay was ever written, everybody faked it as long as they could. Some shabby special effects were thrown into the pot, and the producers crossed their fingers and hoped that everybody who has read the books will want to see the movie. Not if the word gets out, they will.
You're a sick bastard, Mike. You're a sick bastard.
I am a sick bastard. I don't know why he's British. Yeah, Roger and Gene really typified the reaction that Dune got. And it's sad because Dune got it from both angles. It got it from the purists, the Frank Herbert purists, we love these books. And then it also got it from the noobs, the people that are coming to Dune for the first time. And it wasn't going to please anybody. And I'll admit, you know, I came to it as a noob, and I'll say the same things that a lot of people did. The story on first glance is absolutely confusing, depending on what version you see. Either you see Irulan giving you information, or you hear this portentous voiceover guy coming in and giving you way too much information. And then you get more information from the third stage navigator when he comes in. It takes forever for the story to finally get going. And, you know, the third stage guild navigator even says, you know, I see plans within plans. I see two great houses fighting, and you're getting all these weird words thrown at you. You're getting all these different planets thrown at you. There's castle intrigue. And yeah, it takes a long time for the story to finally get going. At least that's how it felt the first time I ever saw the film.
Agreed. You know, I told you pre-show, the first 50 minutes of Dune are nothing but basically talking heads. It's really interesting in comparison to how the you know, theatrical version comes out with, you know, Virginia Madsen giving you a little rundown at the beginning of the film. Or in the book, it's not like that. It's you're basically getting your story, and then, you know, she comes in and says this excerpt taken from the Muad'Dib diaries. Like, you know, like she, the princess, is actually the one that's documenting this whole story to a certain degree. In the film, it's 50 minutes of talking heads, and then boom, you know, you're just in this dream state, and then you're in this battle scene. It's interesting.
One of the biggest complaints of people going to see the movie was just how confusing it was. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but after a while, and maybe when the movie first came out, but I think it was shortly thereafter, movie theaters were equipped with a little pamphlet that was called The Terminology of the Imperium. It was a little, like a cheat sheet of all the houses and all the planets and all this, and it just kind of gave you a heads up as to what you're about to go into. So basically, they were equipping people with almost like a dictionary or a mini encyclopedia in order to arm themselves to go see this film.
You wouldn't think that. I would rather them hand me a tab of LSD before I went in, because that would have made it for just much more an enriching experience.
Okay, let's take a break for a few seconds. We've got a great version of the Dune theme song, originally done by Toto, but this was done by Peachy from Retroist.com. Thank you very much, and please visit Retroist.com for more of Peachy's fine work.
Everybody, this is Tobar Mayo, the Black Superman, and I'm in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
To grasp Dune, you have to look at the director. And I'll tell you, the greatest lesson I ever learned in that was I had a teacher in college, and he always said, when you're trying to, for lack of a better word, to diagnose or get to the crux of what something actually means, to analyze it, you have to look at its creator, and any theory you put forth has to match the life of the creator. And so if you look at Dune in terms of David Lynch, all of the themes and concepts that intrigue Lynch on all levels that run through his career are very present in Dune.
The whole idea of these waking dreams and Paul being able to see into the future, just whenever he goes into a dream state, that's not what a lot of audiences going to see this film were expecting. I'm hoping with this episode to really reach a lot of folks that haven't seen Dune, or that maybe they saw it once and disliked it and haven't tried it again, my whole goal with this episode is to really push people into giving the film a second chance. This was Lynch's third film. He had done Eraserhead, a project that took him an estimated 5 years to do, and then he got tapped to do The Elephant Man, which was very surprising because it really was a very conventional film when you think about, you know, The Outsider. It was kind of an update of the Flowers for Algernon kind of story. You know, there's even some similar scenes between the two. And then he got picked to do Dune. And for a while, his name was bandied about to do Return of the Jedi. I don't know how true that was or not. I think I really would have liked to have seen a David Lynch Return of the Jedi. I believe that he knew that he would have gone head-to-head against George Lucas with that. Instead, he went head-to-head a little bit with the De Laurentiis's, but, you know, he had a lot of control when it came to the shooting of the film, and the real problem was the editing of the film. To that end, I've got a clip here of David Lynch talking about the leeway that he had when it came to Dune, so let's play that.
I never read science fiction, and Dune is a strange science fiction because it has other things, you know, woven into it. In Dune, some things could fall away, and I still felt that it was still saying Dune, and other things had to stay because if they went away, it wouldn't say Dune. And so I just tried to tune into the material and be true to the book and get it down to a realistic length. It took a long time. It was a year and a half working on the script, and then many, many rewrites in the middle of shooting to make things more understandable. And I was always finding these little pieces of this puzzle. Suddenly, I'd realize some part was, you know, missing and have to fix something.
You had mentioned Princess Irulan at the beginning of the theatrical version, and she's at the beginning of some of the fan versions that I've seen, and there is more of her that you can see on one of the DVD versions, the one that came out in 2006. There's a whole introduction that she does, which is really just way too long, and I can see why they cut it, because she just basically encapsulates the entire universe of Dune before the movie starts. Get on with it already. To me, it makes sense to have her at the beginning, and it makes sense to have her as the voiceover narrator that happens a few times in the story. I mean, I think some of the problems that people have, her voiceover just kind of brushes over 3 years of history at one point. That is one of the problems that people who are fans of the book have, is that it takes so long for the story to get going, and then you just kind of condense 100 pages to within maybe two lines of dialogue and just a few scenes, you know, where she says, in the three standard years that followed, and you just get the entire Arrakeen campaign of Muad'Dib against the Harkonnens, you know, and it just is kind of crazy.
You know, you're right, but it's okay. Like, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I can understand how you'd be outraged, but again, it's David Lynch's movie. It's his vision. He can do whatever he wants with it, you know? And had they not given the princess the beginning of the movie, A, it wouldn't be faithful to the book. B, Virginia Madison would only be in one other scene. She'd be walking by the emperor, and that would be it.
She has one line in the movie that isn't said in voiceover. She just says the word father, and that's it.
So she's probably fighting for that intro to be there the whole time.
The other significant scene with her, and I don't even know if she's got dialogue in this scene, it was towards the end of the film, which they had cut out. They're in the Emperor's tent on Arrakis, and Paul lays out the whole thing about how Irulan is going to be his wife, and then he, you know, tells Chani that Chani's going to be his main squeeze, and Irulan's just there as his trophy wife.
Irulan shall be my wife, opening the way for an Atreides to take the throne.
I sit on the throne.
You will sit on a throne on Seleucus Secundus, your prison planet. Either that or you will die.
The princess shall have no more of me than my name. No child of mine, nor touch, nor softness of glance, nor instant of desire. This is my promise to you,
my love. Think on it, Chani. We who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives.
You know, speaking of Sean Young, man, there is a ton of acting in this movie that, listen, I love this movie to death, and I'll always love it, but looking at it from a critical standpoint, There's a lot of bad acting in this movie. A lot. Sean Young is horrible. Patrick Stewart is horrible. Jürgen is horrible. Jack Nance. Jack Nance is so bad in this movie. Especially when he's like, it almost like he has one of those 1920s cameras in his hand. He's trying to take, like, do something. Like, he's trying to torture someone or take a picture of someone. He's got these weird facial expressions. Like, he's like, it's so funny. And I don't think it makes it a bad movie because it makes them dimensional. But I just don't think that a lot of the actors knew what to do with the material.
There's no subtlety of acting to anyone in the film. And personally, I enjoy that. And I think I will politely disagree with you on that because I really like all the acting. And I love Jack Nance in this film. And when he shows up and he does that whole, "What are your orders?" I find it funny that Erlon's one line in the movie is just the word father. And that fathers, there's such a theme of fathers and basically the death of fathers. I mean, there's this whole parallel between Paul and Chani where they both lose their fathers and they're fighting. The whole movie is really fighting against the Emperor, who is like the ultimate father figure. So it's, to me, it's not any kind of coincidence that this was written in the mid-60s, and it was kind of a rebellion against the status quo. And there was such a theme of rebellion in the film. I mean, the whole, in the book and the film, just the whole idea of the Fremen kind of coming out of the woodwork and taking on the establishment. And there are a lot of things that you could read into this book and into the story. One of them is, you know, the spice as being somewhat of a mind-altering drug. You know, we're just on the eve of the hippy-dippy 60s kind of stuff. So you could say, oh, yeah, this is LSD, and there's no two ways about it.
Well, what's interesting about that, actually, is in the book, you know, it's a very addictive substance. And if you, the more you consume, the more you need. So there's an epidemic there. But yeah, I love that aspect of it because I've always been a huge promoter of LSD. How's that? I love it. But I really appreciate that parallel. And one other thing, and it's just a theory I have, is you know, Herbert was actually from Oregon, or he maybe was from Washington, but he lived in Oregon. And the interesting thing about that is he lived very close to Ken Kesey. And so I have to wonder, it being in, and I don't know if Kesey was actually back in Oregon at that point. He might have been living in California yet, but I still have this fantasy in my head, which is Herbert and Kesey doing huge doses of LSD and talking about science fiction or, you know, or talking about something off the wall. You know, just that's my fantasy.
1965 started to be serialized in 1963. And at that point, the U.S. is in Vietnam in an advisory capacity. I think that a lot of it is Herbert riffing off of that as well, talking about this small force of fighters who are willing to give everything, especially their lives, against this oppressor that's coming in, this kind of outside force, re the U.S. coming into Vietnam, or you could even say the French, however you want to put it. But I don't want to get into it at this point, but really you could say that there were some similar things here that ended up happening in Return of the Jedi, where it was the Ewoks fighting against the Empire, you know, the smaller native forces going against this Imperial force.
Really, the Ewoks are totally the representation of the VC.
Oh yeah, I completely agree with that. And to me, Jabba the Hutt was kind of a major sandworm, and so much of, you know, the whole beginning of Return of the Jedi takes place on a desert planet. Lucas is admitted to being a fan of Herbert, but you could really see a whole lot of similarities. But maybe that's just me reading more into it than I probably should.
Lucas has stolen from a few things.
So you can look at the spice as being a drug, and you can look at some Vietnam analogies. But the thing that I find fascinating about Dune in this day and age, Dune is the first time that I ever heard the word jihad. And to look at Dune, so much of the book is peppered with Middle Eastern terms and concepts. I find it very fascinating now to look at the spice as being more of oil. The whole thing of, I believe the spice is created by the death of a sandworm, which is very similar to the whole, you know, the dinosaurs dying and leaving us with oil. And then this desert dwellers who are out there fighting for their land and their spice and their world and all this, it really kind of plays into what we're seeing and what we have seen for decades and maybe even centuries with the way that the Middle East is run.
Yeah, you know, there's a ton of things you can compare it to. Like, I think that comparisons can be infinite with Dune. You could always find something you can compare it to that's going on in the world. I think that's maybe what makes it so timeless, is that it's relatable in that way. But another thing that's going on there too that's really interesting is the religious metaphors in there, you know. I wouldn't definitely go so far as to say that there's a Christ metaphor, just because of the fact is what the character of Muad'Dib, Paul Atreides, does in the book versus the movie. You know, there's not a Christ parallel, but, you know, there's a Messiah parallel that's similar, I think, to Christ. But, you know, I love that aspect of it, too, is there's a lot of that stuff going on, which makes it really fascinating.
I love the visual metaphors that Lynch used in the film. I talked earlier about the dream states, but one of the things that comes up within the dream, first time I ever saw Dune, the most striking image for me was the scene of Paul putting his hand into the box and seeing what he saw in his mind's eye happening to his hand. And then you get that same hand idea going throughout the film. You see when his father's voiceover is talking about the sleeper must awaken and the hand opening up. And then you even get it when Everett McGill has his hand all bloodied and saying that, you know, here are the 15 soldiers, the Fedakin, and, you know, he has his hand out in the frame. And I love that. It's just, those are the things that help this movie stand apart from other stuff. And I should say, I think one of the things too that turns people off from this film is that it's a science fiction film, but it doesn't look like a science fiction film. There are very few scenes that take place in outer space, but you're not looking at a Buck Rogers kind of thing. There's nobody wearing a silver jumpsuit in this thing. Everything looks old. Everything looks like it's been there, and you're really taken into a completely different world with this film. The production design is absolutely fantastic. You know, just all the little details and everything. You talked about how many details are missing from the book to the screen, but then there are so many details that are on the screen. And I think one of my biggest regrets in life is that I've never seen Dune on the big screen. I can't even imagine looking at this film when it's being projected on a big screen. I've only seen it on a box. I've only seen it on TV.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's all the influence of Lynch, though, too, because going back to his obsessions, and there's a lot of really interesting things going on in terms of the sets, too. The sets look very futuristic, but at the same time, they're also, you know, I think they tie in with Herbert's influence from, like, Middle Eastern, because a lot of the set designs look very Middle Eastern, like, you know, almost like Ali Baba's Golden Palace kind of thing. And I think that ties in well. But, you know, what do you think about the flack that film got for its lackluster special effects?
You know, I don't really think that the special effects are that bad. I mean, Paul riding the sandworm looks pretty bad. And there are a few bad blue screen things, but the actual shots of the sandworms themselves, I think, are great. The ones where you don't see people with them, I love those kind of shots. Yeah, I'll give it to you. I'll say that, you know, some of the outer space stuff doesn't look as good as it might, but it's different than anything else I've ever seen. It's very different, and it definitely gives you a sense of something unreal.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't have any problems with them either. I just think that people may have a problem with them because, again, I think they're not appreciating Lynch vision, which is minimalist, cold, industrial, and a lot of the machinery in the film, the spaceships, are very asymmetrical. There's not a lot of detail to them in terms of the design, like you see like on the Starship Destroyer. There's not a lot of 45-degree angles. There's not a lot of stair designs. Or, you know, I'm talking about, there's not a lot of raised design to them. They're just kind of lumps of metal. But I think that's a Lynch thing versus, you know, I don't think he should get flack for that. It's just, I think that's the world that they're in. I think it's all part of the big picture.
I won't belabor this point too much longer, but I will say this, that if we ever go out into space again, we're not going to be looking at aerodynamic ships, or we shouldn't be thinking in terms of aerodynamics when it comes to space travel. And that's something that a lot of people get hung up on. But when you're outside of an atmosphere, you don't get wind resistance, so you're not looking at aerodynamics. I mean, the Borg cube, it works just as well as the Standard Prize. You know, you don't need to have the aerodynamic stuff. So having those kind of big clunky ships out in space, I won't say it's more realistic, but it definitely, you know, it speaks to the whole idea of like a utilitarian vehicle. This doesn't have to be this big, beautiful, you know, Skyliner or something. It's just a big, like the Guild Navigator ships are just big cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Star Wars killed it for everyone. Maybe it's maybe there's actually a realism there that no one's considering.
The thing that I like about Dune is it plays into the whole dirty space thing. Look at something like Silent Running, and it feels very dirty. You know that somebody's living on that ship. You look at Dark Star, you know, some of these films.
Alien.
Alien, yeah. Alien's the perfect example. The Nostromo that they're on. It's just, yeah, it's dank. It's leaky. It's held together by baling wire. And I have to say, that's probably another thing. It's like I could make a list of all the reasons to hate Dune, but yet, despite all those things, I love it. But one of the things that I could see turning people off is just how ugly the movie is and how ugly the characters are. I mean, those close-ups of Baron Harkonnen with all the boils on his face, and just Leonard Cimino with his amazing head. You know, I love his head, and just all the filth and grime, and even with the Fremen, just how dirty and everything that they are. You know, I love it. It adds texture to everything.
There's a realism added there. You know, one thing, too, we totally forgot to talk about, I really want to talk about, is the homosexuality of Baron Harkonnen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I love, there were some people that criticized that in the movie. You know, oh, my God, I can't believe they have this planet of all men, and, you know, just how gay everybody is. But, you know, that's coming right from Herbert's book as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You could even go so far as, I'm totally reaching here, but the whole heart plug thing and the pulling of the heart plug is the discovery of the anus. How's that?
Well, it definitely is a very sexual metaphor. And I love the shot of the blood pumping across the flowers. Yeah, I love that as kind of like a real crazy sexual metaphor.
But you got to wonder, if it's planned of all men, how does Baron Harkonnen have a nephew?
They don't talk about how Baron Harkonnen is actually Jessica's father. That's why Leah has red hair when you see the very brief shot of her red hair. You know, you don't get that. I've always been curious, like, well, so how did they, make the Baron volunteer for that service? You know, those Bene Gesserits must be really persuasive somehow.
Well, yeah, they got the voice.
Another problem, like I said, this whole episode is really more about the problems of Dune. Another problem that...
And how they're not really problems.
Exactly. Another problem that the film had is how David Lynch lost control of the movie when it came to the very end of it. And let me play a little clip here of him talking about what happened towards the end of the filmmaking process.
Making Dune taught me a lot. Looking back on it, I realized I started selling out on the project right from the very beginning. I knew the people I was working with, and I sort of, you know, this intuition thing was working with them, feeling what they wanted the film to be like, and knowing how far I could drift off that to be the make it the way I wanted to it to be. And it's ended up being a kind of a compromise. You know, it just doesn't, you know, work out so well when that happens.
There was, I think, a polite struggle between De Laurentiis and Lynch in terms of the mood of the film. And, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, I guess, not to sound horrible, but Lynch was kind of silly to not get Final Cut. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, why would you not try to get Final Cut on your third film, especially when you're so successful at that point, making critically acclaimed films that are highly artistic and have a mass appeal?
We tried to get a lot of people to be on this show. Justin reached out to a ton of folks, all the way from David Lynch on down.
But let's point out, too, that we almost got two people. Like, the closest we came were actually getting Kyle MacLachlan and David Lynch. Those are the two closest people we got. Like, I talked to Lynch's his personal assistant, and she was actually really nice, and we talked for a few minutes on the phone, and she told me that she really appreciated our interest in Dune, and that she thought that it was really cool that we were promoting instead of ripping on it, and that ultimately David doesn't do interviews, but not because he dislikes the film, but simply because he still has a hard time dealing with the fact that it was such a horrible experience making it. And then also in the Ed Naha book, that some people almost died making the movie. So you can see how it's not like it's such a disaster. I mean, it is a disaster, but it's not necessarily a disaster in his eyes per se, is just the personal struggles making the film. I mean, you almost give your life when you make a movie. You know, you put so much time into it. And so I can see, I don't have any resentment in the fact that we couldn't talk to anyone.
No, I have no resentment either. And I think that kind of speaks volumes, though, that no one was really willing to talk about the movie because there is such sadness around it. I think that everybody around the film realizes that it could have been better than what it is. And to listen to the first interview clip that we played, just the way that he says 3.5 years, you know, as he's talking about how long he's been working on the project, 3.5 years of his life went into this. So for him to not have Final Cut of the film and to just have that heartache that went along with that, because what ended up on the screen, I will admit, going back and watching that original version, and I'm talking about the original version without the voiceover narration from the guy, without the intro and all that, I will say that the film is really kind of choppy. And it's funny because I've seen the longer version so many times that I'm filling in all the other things that are in the longer version. I guess it's finally time to talk about some of the different versions of this film.
I'm not 100% sure on the timeline, but it might have been around 89, 90 that the Disney Channel started showing Dune. And that was the first time where you got to see the alternate opening, which was, you know, the courtroom scene. Do you know what I'm talking? You know, I'm talking about the courtroom animation that was at the front head voice.
Oh, okay, right? Yeah, yeah. It looked like almost production sketches.
I remember seeing it clear as day on Disney Channel, and then
again, Disney Channel is completely the wrong place to be playing this movie. I mean, I think that maybe when I saw it, it was when Sci-Fi Channel had just started up. I don't know what the timeline was. So we should probably talk a little bit about the different fan edits of the film, because this has been one film that has really just been embraced by the fan edit community. I mean, there are at least four or five different versions that I can think of off the top of my head where people have gone in and dug up clips. Luckily, the 2006 DVD release had just a bevy of extra stuff. And then you've got the TV version. So people are going in, taking all the different versions of this and trying to do what Lynch was unable to do.
Dune is probably, in my eyes, the second most fan-edited film after Phantom Menace.
And then with Dune, it also presents some very interesting technical challenges, which a lot of people have overcome, which I love. One of the problems with the TV version of the film is that they used footage that hadn't really been color corrected. All of the Fremen's blue within blue eyes weren't there. So you could really tell a difference as soon as you went from something that was in the theatrical version versus the television version. So anytime you saw a Fremen with their brown eyes, it was like, whoa, what's going on? What's happening? And then the quality of the image would degrade as well. So there have been fan editors out there, and hats off to these folks dedicated enough to this film to actually go in and color correct all of the Fremen's eyes. So any scene that was in the television version or that was in the 2006 DVD, the extras that were on there, they've gone through and they've cleaned up all that stuff, and they've done what was never done to this movie before and have just made it into a completely new thing.
Yeah, I think it's amazing, actually. It's really fascinating. And to be honest with you, a lot of the extra scenes that were added by some of these guys, I didn't feel were necessary. I just feel like they slowed everything down. I can see why they were cut from a theatrical standpoint. Because some of them, you know, like there's more Shadow at Mape stuff that I saw back in there. And I was just like, man, Linda Hunt was overacting. This is not the year Living Dangerously. You know, this was Dune. And, you know, there's, I don't know if you've seen that scene, Mike, where she brings Lady Jessica the knife. And she just, you know, she draws it and she says, you cannot sheath that knife again without blood on it. And she's, Linda Hunt falls to her knees and screams, rips up her shirt. You know, it's really, really horrible. So, but one of the scenes I did love and I thought was really awesome was the inclusion of right when Paul drinks the water, life. You know, everyone, all the Bene Gesserit women, they start getting the bloody noses in the mouth. And there's that great shot of Alicia Witt as the little girl who gets her nose and her mouth are all bloody. And she crawls over to Lady Jessica and sits on her lap, and they're sitting in the rocks together. And Alicia Witt just starts telling the whole story about how they finally realize that the guild has been behind this all the time. That's like my favorite cut scene. I think it's really well done. And for, you know, however old she was, look how great she was, you know, it's amazing.
All right, we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we return, we will be back with Ed Naha, the man who wrote the book about the making of Dune. All right, we are back. Recently, Justin and I had a chance to sit down with Ed Naha, the author of The Making of Dune. Mr. Naha was the first editor of Fangoria magazine, as well as the screenwriter for several films, including my personal favorite, Chud 2, Bud the Chud, as well as Dolls and Troll.
First off, how did you get the gig to do the book?
Everything about Dune was convoluted. Back then, they did making of books based on films, and usually books were set to coincide with the beginning of film production. This wasn't. For some reason, people were worried about installing a writer on the set. It was a film that was literally the biggest movie ever done at that point in terms of budget and scope. So the studio and the licensing people didn't get the book going in time. I had done a few novelizations, and the publicist knew me, called up my agent, and I went on basically a series of interviews. I think they wanted to see whether or not I had rabies or something, and I was going to go down there and bite people. The folks liked me, and so they sent me down to the set, but at that point, the production was, 4 or 5 months in, so it was kind of playing catch-up.
But you had plenty of time, it sounds like. I mean, the whole production was, 3.5 years or something, I kept hearing?
Yeah, I mean, it was huge. Pre-production was 2.5 years. The thing that was funny about Dune is that in spite of all the pre-production, when they got down to Cherubusco Studios, nothing worked. It was like, that was the wonderful aspect of this movie to witness. This movie was watching people fight reality. Under normal circumstances, that's difficult. Filming at Cherubusco Studios at that time, it made it 10 times harder.
So can you talk a little bit about the stories about how, you know, how people almost died making the movie?
You had makeup effects that went badly. Probably the worst one was Jürgen Prochnow. In a nightmare sequence, he's supposed to rip off half of his cheek, and smoke is supposed to come out of his cheek. So they had tested this facial bladder, and they were pumping smoke up into the bladder, and then he'd just rip it. So they tested it, but they never tested it with the bladder firmly affixed to the cheek. So as they were filming this, Prochnow screamed and started clawing at his face. They thought, wow, this is a beautiful performance. But what happened was, because the bladder was sealed tightly, the smoke became incredibly hot and actually burned his real flesh. And he had second and third degree burns on his face. That was his last shot. And they used it in the film. But it was one of these things that really, you know, people were just like, oh, my God. You know, he was one of the stars of the movie. Somebody, I forget what effects fella, told me that the whole movie was done on the fly. And that's true. Everyone had to think on their feet because nothing went right. The people Dino hires are artists. I mean, they're craftsmen. They're just magnificent. The stuff that they make in terms of sets and things like that, it's art. You had all these people going down there, and you had Freddie Francis, cinematographer, you know, Lynch as director. You had all these people who had, you know, who really were the top people, and they had a huge crew of local people. Most of these folks didn't know anything about movie making, especially movie making of this caliber. So initially, they were going to use sort of a computer controlled system similar to Star Wars. So they hired a whole bunch of folks from Star Wars. They sent them down there. And because the electricity was on and off, it couldn't be used. So after setting everything up, they had to strike that, send everyone home, and get a second bunch of special effects people who would do effects the old-fashioned way with models of ships. Everything was done in a physical sense, you know, wire rigging and miniatures. Now, some of the things that they had to do with the miniatures, they couldn't use regular sand because the granules would be too big. So in post-production, they had to recreate all the sand dunes. But what they used on top were little glass pellets, and they blew them around. Now, if you inhale those, they stay in your lungs. A lot of things along those lines happened 10 years after making this film. Burnt tires were used for smoke in some of the battle sequences. And so that was blowing around while sand and grit was blowing around. Almost everyone wore surgical masks. It was sort of like Where do you want to shoot? How about Chernobyl? Okay. You know, I would not want to see these people 10 years after.
You talk a lot about the press coming down and they were kind of treated as outsiders a little bit, but how were you treated when you were on the set?
So I had a cool time. The people were very, very, everyone was really, really nice. It's hard to describe because this thing was like fighting a war, overcoming every obstacle. And to a man and to a woman, everybody on both sides of the camera, just everyone was 100% plus. And it's just in spite of the language barriers, and everyone had this really dark sense of humor, which really helps. I call it cop humor. You know, it's really, really dark because it was one of these deals where if something could go wrong, it did go wrong at least twice.
I couldn't believe all of the things that customs were holding up, all the stories in your book about that.
Oh, it was phenomenal. I mean, the Sopranos could have learned from these guys. I think, you know, it would have been nice if they had like a separate budget just for greasing the palms of the authorities. In a sense, that always happens to a degree when you shoot overseas. But at the time, they couldn't even count on things like electricity. They couldn't count on phones. So it was really like filming on the fly. Everyone had to work when they could and then sit while reality of the situation came up to speed.
How long were you on the set when you were down there?
I was on the set the first time, I guess, 3 weeks. Then I went down for a few days, and then I went down for a couple of weeks after they were doing second unit and the effects. Just shooting the miniature worms, they had more light in that small room when they were shooting the miniature worms. The amount of light in that room was brighter than the amount of light outside in the sun. They needed it so bright to catch the movements. And then Carlo Rambaldi created sculpted the sandworms. But the deal was you had to be careful how you filmed them because filmed from the wrong angle, it looked like a porno movie. You had these sandworms that looked like schlongs. You know, it was just like, so they had to be filmed on an angle and lit in such a way that it didn't look like dune dildos. Could have been an interesting marketing tool, so to speak, but, you know, you don't think about any of this stuff when you're initially signing off on a movie. Like, oh, gee, I hope the monsters don't look like dildos, you know.
One of the things I find fascinating about your book is you've got so many scenes that were shot that were just never used in any of the versions that I've seen, like Raban in the bathtub or a whole lot with Jamis's wife. I mean, it does really sound like it was all very much on-the-spot filmmaking.
It's an odd thing. You know, for me as a reader, there are some books that defy filmmaking. You know, at one point, prior to Dino having it, it was going to be done as a 10-hour epic. And Salvador Dali was going to be in it, and Orson Welles, and I think David Carradine, and it was huge. And then David Lynch was brought in. This was after The Elephant Man. I don't know the page count of his script, but he had so many. His scenes were so detailed. Every scene was detailed. Every scene, if a filmmaker... A director would film a scene. Let's say he had five levels, five things he wanted to say in one scene that were necessary. Lynch would look at the same scene and find 10. I mean, he was meticulous. And the scene with the tub and the light bulb. Paul Smith is a huge, huge man. He took so many chances because when you're that big and you're working in that heat, you know, and basically you're covered with rubber. You're two steps away from keeling over. And in that one scene with the bathtub, I mean, there were live wires all around him. But, you know, at a certain point, everyone just went, okay, I want to be part of Lynch's vision, and I trust him. And they did it.
What was your first impression of David Lynch when you met him?
Lynch is wonderful. Lynch is sort of like the young college art professor who everyone loves because he thinks so far outside the box. It's almost a stream of consciousness. One of the nicest things about watching him direct was the relationship he had with different actors. He made the actors as invested in the scene as he was. On a film where there were literally actors coming and going. It's almost like they were being airlifted in for a week's work and then being shipped out. You had a huge cast on this. There was always work being done on the sets. So for him to really make it a personal relationship with the actors and cut through all the din that was going on physically around the set was really fascinating. He was an amazingly insightful man.
How downplayed is the aspect that Lynch and De Laurentiis actually struggled with each other in terms of, you know, how Lynch wanted to make a darker movie?
Really, I don't know the extent of the disagreements between the De Laurentiis camp and Lynch. I think the amount of footage that was shot would have been a three-hour movie. I don't know how long the director's cut is. I've never seen it. But I feel, just having been on the set and seeing what was filmed and seeing some of the rough footage, you know, and the outtakes, because I got to see the outtakes, a lot of the outtakes when I was doing the book, that would have been something along the lines of the Lawrence of Arabia of science fiction. It would have been the kind of movie that you'd have an intermission. I know you certainly couldn't do that today because people have the attention spans of a gnat. And if there's not an explosion in the first 7 minutes of the film or under the credits, you're not going to capture anyone's attention. I don't know that back then you could have done that either. The studio certainly was interested in marketing this as a science fiction film, and marketing something as a science fiction film, you assume certain things. You assume you're going to get X amount of people. And when you look back at that time period, every science fiction film that was based really on ideas, the studio always edited. Blade Runner, Dune, there weren't a lot of films that were just left alone. They were considered, you know, they were either too complicated or too smart. But at the time of the filming, I didn't see any of that. You know, I wasn't privy to that.
After the film came out, did you follow like the critical backlash that Dune got?
No, I figured that this wasn't going to be critic-pleasing because of the way it was released. There was something in there to offend everybody, and it wasn't anyone's intentions to do that. Well, it never is, but had the original film been released, the film critics who hadn't read the book would have been just going, I don't, what? Where do the big worms come from? And the way it was presented, a lot of fans of the book would be upset. I figured no one was going to like it.
One thing that I didn't know until I read Ed Naha's book is that Alicia Witt, in a lot of the medium shots of her walking, that she's not actually walking, that she's on her knees on a board, and they're pulling her while she's moving her knees from side to side. So she looks a lot shorter than she was. And then in the longer shots, she was, I believe, 8 at the time, and they would use a 3-year-old to be her stand-in because the 3-year-old was the height that they wanted her to be. The other thing that's fascinating to me, talking about longer cuts of this film, is all the stuff that we still haven't seen with this movie. I know that Lynch was doing a lot of experimentation on the set, which is interesting. There was one whole scene that he kind of came up with this larger weirding module where all of the Fremen warriors inside of this room and they're, I don't know, for lack of a better term, they're chanting, and through the power of their voice, they're making this thing spin around. And there's a whole story in the book about how the top of this thing wasn't painted right and how they, you know, painted it with the wrong paint and then they had to come back and repaint it. And it's really more of a story about that. But for me, I'm fascinated by, so where is this scene? There's a whole thing with Molly Ringwald talking about how she comforts Aaliyah, and all of that stuff is just gone. Okay, well, we've got this disc on the latest release of Dune. Where are all these scenes? Those would be kind of nice to see as well. They don't necessarily have to be put back in the movie, but it sure would be nice to see that footage. One of the other things that really got to people was the whole inner voice. I was really hard-pressed to think of another one, and I'm hoping that we can get some people that will call me out for not remembering some of the other films that might use an inner voice. But, and I'm not talking about voiceover. I'm talking about actually hearing a character's thoughts in between what they're saying, or just kind of offhand, just to hear the Bene Gesserit mother coming in and like, is he the one? And just kind of that low whisper. And I know that that probably drove people absolutely nuts when they saw it the first time.
No, I actually like that about the movie. I enjoy it.
I love, especially when they talk about the prophecy themes.
That's just a, you know, it's a tool to advance the mythos a little bit along, I think, and it's done really well. You know, it's, you know, leaves the viewer in the suspended state of whether this guy is actually something special or if he's just a dumb kid that's going to get killed 10 minutes from now. It's done brilliantly, though. Like I've said a few times, it's kudos to David Lynch because he had the task of paring down multiple hundreds of pages into basically 200 pages of script, more or less. And I think he did a really good job. Like, he cut things perfectly where they should be cut. In terms of the finished film, I don't think it's a bad film.
Looking at the original Book of Dune, the story is only, and I say I put only in quotation marks, it's only 300-some pages, but then you get like 200 pages of basically that same thing I was talking about before, the terminology of the Imperium, and you get all these like history of Arrakis and all of these things. Frank Herbert was a history buff, and it definitely comes through with all of the supplemental material that he gives to the story, and there's no way that you're going to capture all of that. But yeah, I would say that Lynch, it was Lynch and the two guys that he worked with on Elephant Man took the first swipe at the screenplay, but then after that, Lynch worked on it, and as he said earlier in one of the interviews, he did 7 versions of the screenplay, and this was the last one that they filmed. I haven't seen an adaptation of such a bulky amount of material since Lord of the Rings, and Lord of the Rings really didn't ruffle a whole lot of feathers. You know, the Tom Bombadil fans were really pissed because Treebeard gets a lot of his lines, but it was very smart what they did with that adaptation. The things that one character said made more sense for another character to say, and even in the Dune adaptation, you know, you meet Stilgar a lot earlier in the book than you do in the film, but it made more sense for his lines to be said by Dr. Kynes, so then you can introduce him earlier. I know that you have some problems with the beginning, that it does take a little while to get going, but the way that they introduce and what order they introduce the characters in, to me, makes a lot of sense. Meet Gurney and Yui and Thufir all at one time, rather than, and then here's this character, and you know, he leaves the room, and then this character comes in, and then he leaves the room, and then this third character comes in. It's like, no, just bring them all into the friggin' room at the same time. Any version that begins with that male narrator and that has the male narrator throughout the film is a failure to me. Period. End of sentence. Irulan should start that film. And I don't even care if it's the longer Irulan speech opening up the film. I think it goes on for too long. Though I do love the one part where she fades out and then comes back and says, oh yes, I forgot to tell you. You know, which is just absolutely bizarre to me. But it's great. I agree with you that some of these fan edits go overboard putting in footage that doesn't necessarily need to be there, that detract from the pacing of the story.
And it gives Virginia Madsen more lines.
Exactly. And this is back when Virginia Madsen was really kind of hot, so that was kind of nice too. David Lynch has never gotten over the trauma that he underwent with Dune. Even a few years ago when he put out his book, The Big Fish, which is more about his transcendental meditation, he was talking throughout the book about some of the older film projects that he's done. And he talks very briefly about Dune, but I wanted to play that clip for us here to see where he's at even in recent years with this project.
It's totally absurd for filmmakers not to be able to make films the way they want to make them. But in this business, it's very common. I came from painting, and a painter has none of those worries. A painter paints a painting. No one comes in and says, you've got to change that blue. It's a joke to think that a film is going to mean anything if somebody else fiddles with it. If they give you the right to make the film, they owe you the right to make it the way you think it should be. The filmmaker should decide on every single element, every single word, every single sound, every single thing going down that highway through time. Otherwise, it won't hold together. The film may suck, but at least you made it suck on your own. When I made Dune, I didn't have Final Cut. It was a huge, huge sadness because I felt I had sold out, and on top of that, the film was a failure at the box office. I knew I was getting into trouble when I agreed not to have Final Cut. I was hoping it would work out, but it didn't. So for me, Dune was a huge failure. The end result is not what I wanted, and that's a sadness.
people need to give it another chance. It's a great film. It fits in very well with his filmography. It makes sense as a David Lynch film. It's not going to make sense as a Rock'em Sock'em kind of sci-fi opera. There's none of that. You're going to go in there and you're going to have your mind blown only the way that David Lynch can do it.
And it's pretty good for a movie directed by Alan Smithy.
And written by Judas Booth. It's strange because Judas Booth really had never written anything else that I can find on the IMDb. So it's really strange. I don't know what happened to him afterward.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
All right. That's enough for me for Dune. Thank you very much for listening to the Projection Booth. Justin's down getting some juju bees. Next week, he'll be back in full force with Red Scorpion, including a great interview with Dolph Lundgren. I'm going to play you out here with Dancing Galaxy by Astral Projection. I think you'll understand why once the song starts going.
Spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
This is David Lynch, all rights reserved.